Welcome to Scope It Out. In this edition, Dr. Smith will be speaking with Dr. Zara Patel on her article, Comparison of Outcomes Following Culture-Directed versus Non-Culture-Directed Antibiotics in Treatment of Acute Exacerbations of Chronic Rhinosinusitis. Scope It Out is made possible by support from FIAGON and Karl Storz Endoscopy America.
Hello and welcome to Scope It Out, the podcast of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology. I'm your host, Dr. Tim Smith, and today I'm very happy to be joined by Dr. Zara Patel from Palo Alto, California. We will be discussing her article, which is currently available online and entitled Comparison of Outcomes Following Culture-Directed versus Non-Culture-Directed Antibiotics in Treatment of Acute Exacerbations of Chronic Rhinosinusitis. Zara, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Tim. It's so great to be here.
Well, thank you. Antibiotics and chronic rhinosinusitis. I mean, where do we even start with this particular topic? I'm really looking forward to your insights because sometimes I don't think I know anything anymore, especially with the more recent revelations about the microbiome and the revelations from your paper. I mean, I do know this. I used to prescribe a minimum of 3 weeks of empiric or culture-directed antibiotics to everyone who had an acute exacerbation of chronic rhinosinusitis. And cultures were routinely performed in my practice. Maybe, let's say, that was 15 years ago, 20 years ago even. Now, I probably don't use antibiotics for many of the acute exacerbations. And when I do use antibiotics, I use them for their anti-inflammatory effects. And I almost never culture. So
right.
I guess I'm confused and looking for your guidance on this, Zara. Why don't you tell me about why you studied this and how you went about it?
So I basically was feeling the same way, that the more I went to our meetings and learned more about the sinus microbiome from our colleagues who were studying that more in depth and read their papers and realized that when we culture patients, we are not really getting a good reflection of what's truly going on in the sinus cavity. The idea of depending on that culture to direct patient care suddenly seemed maybe a little quaint.
Yeah.
Like we thought we were doing something. We thought we knew what we were doing, and really we're just using the best information we have at any time. But now we have a lot better information. We have new technology that can tell us these hundreds of different bacteria that are normally found in our sinuses. And we know that cultures, number one, do not reflect even a small percentage most of the time of that huge diversity. And then number two, they often do not represent what the actual pathogenic bacteria may be if we actually have some sort of infection going on. Based on that, I wanted to look at this.
Very, very well said. And yeah, I think we all still, well, let's get into this a little bit more, but my sense is that we all are just holding way too much faith in this very archaic, almost, medical test. And even in the year 2018, I know that there are a lot of people who put a lot of stock in that one bacteria that they are identifying on these cultures. And if they could just eradicate that one bacteria,
right,
it's as if this entire process would somehow resolve. So tell us how you went about studying this.
So I first just wanted to look at our data that we had so far. You know, certainly when you're starting to think about looking at something, we know, you know, looking prospectively is probably the best way to do that, to remove as many biases as possible. But sometimes you get a good idea as to how to frame that prospective study by looking back retrospectively at your own patients. And so that's where I started. So we basically looked back over the patients at the Stanford Sinus Center, people coming in with chronic sinusitis with acute exacerbations, the ones that we would culture or treat with antibiotics. And we decided that we wanted to both look at the short-term outcomes and long-term outcomes, meaning we looked at both one Kennedy score, so we could have some sort of objective and endoscopic exam, and then also the SNOT-22 scores to get patients' quality of life perspective as well.
Okay,
and then,
so just to clarify that, Zara, for our listeners, you really had two main outcomes. One was a objective clinician-based outcome, nasal endoscopy, and the other was an objective patient-based outcome, a validated quality of life instrument specific to sinonasal disease.
Exactly. And then because it was, you know, difficult looking backwards to have these patients following up at exactly the same time, we kind of took the short-term outcomes to be the less than 1 month follow-up, and then long-term outcomes to be 1 to 6 months follow-up because patients came back at random times within those periods. But I think that separating it that way actually gave us a good look at, you know, what happens right after you treat with these antibiotics and what happens a little ways later.
Yeah.
And then we collected data like demographics, patient comorbidities that we thought were important, any prior surgical history. And of course, when we're looking at patients with chronic sinusitis, we wanted to analyze things like whether or not they had eosinophilia, whether or not they had cystic fibrosis or asthma, those sort of comorbidities, whether they had nasal polyps. So we looked at those types of things as well.
Gotcha. Okay. And you mentioned selection bias, and the biases that are probably represented here are the fact that when you did your initial search, you found somewhere around 950 patients who were treated with antibiotics, but only about, let's say, 15% of those, 122, I think, to be exact, had all the data necessary to really examine them based on your primary outcomes.
That's right. Certainly, I think all of us have patients who we know well enough, they've been in our practice, and if they call in and tell us that, hey, I'm having an acute infection in the setting of their chronic thing, sometimes we will go ahead and prescribe something for them without having them come in first, and so they will be missing that pre-treatment endoscopy and SNOT-22. And then, of course, certainly there are patients, I think in both groups, who once they are treated, if they're feeling just great and fine, are not necessarily going to follow up with us after the fact. And so certainly that introduces a selection bias into the types of patients that we're able to collect this data on.
Yeah. It was interesting that of the 122 patients that you collected data on, they were split equally between culture-directed and empiric therapy, 61 patients in each group. When I first read it, I thought, oh, wow, they must have ran. Wait, they didn't randomize this. How did they get to 61?
I actually had to edit out the fellow's writing where she said we had perfect separation.
<Yeah. Right. laughs>
Because it did work out quite well that we had that. But I think it's very rare that you have something that splits so evenly, but I think we just kind of lucked out in the way that ended up in our retrospective review.
Right. And so similar numbers, pretty similar demographics, but they differed in these two groups. The one group was treated with culture-directed antibiotics. The other treated with empiric antibiotic therapy. They differed on a couple of important baseline characteristics. One is whether they'd had a history of prior sinus surgery before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another was their baseline endoscopy score. And as it turned out, I think both of those two factors, prior surgery and a higher or a worse baseline endoscopy examination, occurred in the culture-directed group.
That's right. And I think that this is exactly those sort of biases that can come about when you're looking back, because to me it does make sense that in patients who have had prior surgery, number one, we are able to get a more granular look at those sinuses. And so perhaps our Lund Kennedy scoring might be affected by just the fact that we can see into those sinuses after some of that surgery.
Case in point, you have a patient who's had sinus surgery who has an acute exacerbation, and you can see the purulent material in their maxillary sinus because you're looking right through the antrostomy,
right,
versus another patient where you're at the mercy of whether that virulence is draining out of the osteomedial complex, and you can see it in and around the middle meatus and uncinate process.
Exactly. Exactly. And so the other thing, one other thing that we found, which I found interesting because I don't actually use this very much in my own practice, but the use of topical antibiotics was also increased in that group. And I think that also speaks to the fact that certainly I think it's a pretty rare subset of patients that we even use topical antibiotics in. And of those patients, certainly they're going to be the post-surgical patients because I don't think anyone thinks that rinsing with topical antibiotics without having opened the sinus is going to do much of anything. So, I think that those things are part and parcel of looking back and not being able to control, although we did try to control for that in the analysis with the multi-regression analysis.
Right. Well, you compared these two groups and tell us, what'd you find? I mean, what's better, culture-directed or empiric antibiotics?
Yeah, so interestingly, we found that using the patient-based outcomes score, the SNOT 22 score, they were actually no different between the two groups, either in the short-term outcome or in the long-term outcome. And when you looked at the physician-based nasal endoscopy score, there was no difference in the short-term outcome, but there was a difference in the long-term outcome where the culture-directed group did have a significantly sort of increased improvement in the endoscopy score.
So their examination, their endoscopic, the mucosa, the level of edema, purulent material, crusting, those things that seem to be improved in the longer term, which means somewhere around, say, 6 months to a year.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. And what do you make of that, Zara?
Yeah.
I mean, is that just, gosh, you continued to treat these patients with a variety of medications and you supported them during an acute exacerbation, so of course, 6 to 12 months later, they look better on exam.
Right. I'm not putting a lot of weight into that one outcome measure, especially in this retrospective sort of look.
Yeah.
We are now looking prospectively at the same exact question and trying to control for all of these types of things. So maybe we will get to a sort of more definitive type of answer because in my mind, it wasn't that what was not surprising was were the other outcomes, the no difference in SNOT 22 and no difference in the short term, because then as I sort of started this whole thing, you know, the more we know about the sinus microbiome and how little the cultures actually reflect what's going on, I didn't actually expect to see a huge difference. And the fact that, you know, I wasn't trying to compare sort of these culture-directed antibiotics to a non-appropriate antibiotic, right? I wasn't trying to see, oh, when we treat these patients with something they're resistant to, then what's the outcome? It's more like, what's the utility of doing this culture if the empiric antibiotic, which most of us will start with an amoxicillin or Augmentin because that's what's in most guidelines to start with for treating these types of acute infections. If we're using that and that does actually tend to cover most of the things that we would culture anyway, probably it is going to be about the same in those different groups.
Right.
So the fact that we did see a difference in that long-term endoscopy, that was actually the most surprising outcome to me. And I sort of don't know how much weight to really put on that.
It's interesting to hear you say that and be so frank about it. As I was reading the paper, I thought to myself the same thing. I thought to myself, well, yeah, I don't know that that tells me a whole lot, honestly. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you have a question, it's good to get some preliminary data. And, you know, I think what you've done here with a retrospective evaluation, you've recognized in the discussion, you've clearly delineated all of these selection biases that we've talked about.
Yeah.
But you've gathered some important preliminary data that says, you know, this really is a question worth asking, and now we need to study it in a more robust way, and that's what you're doing. I think that's great, and that's what we hope to achieve with our research. You also made a comment in your discussion, which, gosh, really rings true with my clinical practice, and that is, a lot of the times you start an empiric antibiotic even when you've obtained a culture. And then by the time the culture result comes back, you find that the empiric antibiotic you've prescribed, the bacteria that you've grown are not sensitive to that empiric antibiotic. So you call the patient to change their antibiotic, but they're feeling much better. I mean, I would say that is the rule rather than the exception in my practice.
I think that, you know, that speaks to many of the things we're sort of touching on.
Yeah.
That number one, people probably do have some innate ability to clear or improve on their own if they just continue doing the topical regimen that probably all of us have them on to begin with to, you know, treat this chronic sinusitis. And when someone has an exacerbation, maybe they don't always need to be given any antibiotic. Well, that's a whole different question. But then when we do give them an empirically prescribed antibiotic, number one, maybe it is enough to sort of affect a lot of different bacteria. But number two, what's probably most important is that we know that when the sinus microbiome is looked at more robustly than a culture using PCR analysis or something like that, an antibiotic is used, the shift in those bacteria is not necessarily because of the exact bacteria that the antibiotic is directed to. Sometimes another bacteria is a pathogenic bacteria, and just the change in diversity or the change in amount of the surrounding bacteria bring the number of that pathogenic bacteria down, even though it wasn't what was being directed, the treatment was being directed to. So there's so much that we still do not know or understand about how we're affecting this entire microbiome by treating it. And that should give us all pause, I think, in treating them. And thinking about, you know, you could bring all the different sort of global themes of antibiotic overprescription and growing resistance and those sort of things into this. But even in our individual patients, perhaps we are doing a disservice by treating them with these things that we think we're doing to help them. I think that we need to take the time to really try to understand that better before just continuing on down this path that we've been on for many years.
Right, right. So many unintended consequences from antibiotics, some of which are adverse, and we know about that, and some of which actually help the patient, but for reasons that were not even on our radar screen, like altering the microbiome so that another group of bacteria take care of the pathogen in some way, shape, or form. This all reminds me of a conversation that I had. It was probably 15 years ago at the back of one of our meeting halls at a national meeting, and it was with Stilkantakis and Don Leopold, who I think I would consider, at least from my conversations with them previously, really early adopters of this idea that, gosh, we have no idea what we're doing with these antibiotics. And I remember them saying to me, you know, Still said, I don't use antibiotics. I only prescribe oral steroid therapy for my acute exacerbations of chronic rhinosinusitis. And I looked at him like he was from another planet, you know, 15 years ago, because all of that was, actually against what the guidelines were saying at that time. And then Don Leopold explained to me when he saw the look on my face, and he said, Tim, he said, use steroids to alter the environment of the sinuses, to reduce the inflammation. And just that alteration of the environment creates a situation where those pathogenic bacteria no longer want to live. For both of them, it was more about treating with steroid therapy than it was about treating with antibiotic therapy. And now, when we look at antibiotics and how they're used in acute exacerbations or in chronic rhinosinusitis in general, there seems to be this European pattern of antibiotic use and the more American pattern of antibiotic use. And in your study, you used more the American pattern. That's the amoxiclav or sulfa-based antibiotics.
There were some patients given like a bioxin, clarithromycin type of thing, more along the lines of the European model, but that wasn't as common, certainly.
Right. And I bet you, well, I'm curious, but in the future, I'm seeing more and more Americans adopt this more European model of antibiotic use. And just to explain to the listeners who aren't following us necessarily here, macrolides, which clearly have anti-inflammatory effects, and drugs like doxycycline, which appear to have anti-inflammatory effects, are more commonly used, well, because they're antibiotics, but they also have an anti-inflammatory effect that we're all trying to take advantage of. And so I know in my practice, tell me your practice, Zara, but in my practice, I'm using more, I guess, macrolides, doxycycline. We have trouble with the macrolides in the United States because of so many patients on statin therapy and and other drugs that interact with the macrolides. Are you using those antibiotics more than historically?
I would say that overall in my practice, I am. It's more in patients who are initially coming to me for the first time and they've, you know, already been through all these different treatments and sometimes been through surgery before. Those are usually the patients that I will try a course like that on. It's less common for me to use it in this sort of acute flare of a CRS patient, like the ones that I studied in this paper. And I think that that's maybe just because of my sort of preset mindset that I'm not used to reaching for that other type of antibiotic treatment in this setting.
Yeah.
And maybe it is something that I'll start to incorporate more. And I'm curious, just like everyone else would be, I think about what the outcome will be of this prospective study, and that probably will affect what I end up doing once we see if there is any difference based on these decisions that we're making.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and I think it's changing just so rapidly right now, especially with this introduction to the microbiome that we've all been given over these last several years and the complexities of this situation that we are trying to simplify. It's what we do, right? We try as physicians, a lot of times as clinicians, we try to control some situation by oversimplifying it. And I think we're probably all guilty of that with antibiotics in the management of these disease processes. Well, Zara, thank you so much for joining me. I look forward to this prospective study, and let's get you back on the podcast when those study results are available, because I'm sure that will be fascinating in and of itself.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Tim, and yes, I will definitely report back.
Thank you for listening. Scope It Out is a co-production of the International Forum of Allergy and Rhinology and Wiley. All opinions in this podcast are those of Dr. Smith and his guests and do not necessarily reflect those of Wiley or of the sponsors.